Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio show. My guest for this morning is award-winning former journalist and author Steve Piacenti. Steve and I will be discussing about his latest novel titled Bootlicker. It is a prequel to his debut novel titled Bella. Good morning, Steve. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen talk radio. How are you doing this morning?
Hi, Johnny. It's wonderful to be with you. Thanks for having me on the show.
Wonderful. Bootlicker is a great read. It is very realistic. And interestingly enough, what's a perfect timing for you for its release during this current political and election cycle. So congratulations.
Thank you. We like to say that Bootlicker is an election year story you won't find in the New York Times.
It definitely is. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Okay, I'm a native New Yorker, born and bred in New York, and I went to school in Washington, D.C. during the Watergate era, and I got involved with the school newspaper, and fully intended to be the next Woodward or Bernstein when I came out of college. I was going to cover the president, or I was going to cover the Congress, and unfortunately, those lofty expectations were a little bit too lofty in the beginning, and I wound up instead covering the Naples High School Golden Eagle football team down in Naples, Florida. I started off as a high school sports reporter.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I did that for a couple of years, and then I moved up in the state to Central Florida. Florida is one of those funny states where the further north you move, the more southern it becomes.
Mm-hmm.
And I moved up to Lakeland, the Lakeland Ledger, which is a New York Times-owned newspaper, and switched over from sports to news and started covering some local issues, caught the attention of the Tampa Tribune, which is 30 miles west.
Mm-hmm.
Was invited to apply for a job, and in 1985 wound up coming back to Washington as a Washington correspondent for the Tampa Tribune. I did that job for a little while, and then wound up taking a similar job with the Charleston, South Carolina paper as their Washington correspondent. So you can see that this native New Yorker came up through Southern journalism.
Very interesting. I'm sure there are a whole lot of stories to write about the South, though.
The South was a very different experience for me,
yeah,
from where I grew up on Long Island.
Yeah.
And opened my eyes to a lot of things. And, you know, there were a lot of wonderful things about the South. There were some things I didn't think were so wonderful. But,
mm-hmm,
you know, it was a terrific experience and definitely opened my eyes about a lot of things.
When did you discover you like to write?
Oh, gosh. I probably discovered it without realizing it as a child.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in an era when TV was three channels and two colors, black and white.
Mm-hmm.
I got kind of very interested in comic books, particularly Superman comic books, and I kind of devoured them. I loved reading about them. I loved the way it fired up my imagination. So that's, you know, early childhood reading, writing memories go,
mm-hmm,
back to those days. You know, then as I got older, I realized that I was a lot better at the writing side of things than I was the math and science side of,
mm-hmm,
things.
Mm-hmm.
So I could write about people who could do that, but I couldn't, mm-hmm, do it myself. So I gravitated toward English and composition and,
mm-hmm,
you know, eventually newspaper work.
I see. Did you read a lot when you were growing up?
I did read a lot. I had a mother who was an avid, voracious reader,
mm-hmm,
and she kind of instilled that love in me. And so, yeah, I was always reading, whether it was, you know, started off comic books, but then,
yeah,
I remember reading the Hardy Boy mysteries and then,
mm-hmm,
graduating to more, you know, serious and adult literature.
Mm-hmm. Who are some of your favorite authors?
Okay, well, going back, you know, I started off, one of my favorite authors was Steinbeck, and I read all of his novels, and,
mm-hmm,
you know, everything from Sweet Thursday to Travels with Charlie. I just love those books and the way he captured the humanity of America. More recently, I really, really like an author named Annie Proulx, who mm-hmm. is the author of The Shipping News, which won the Pulitzer Prize.
Mm-hmm.
I like that for the style of writing. I think she's one of our most unique writers. But I also liked it because it was about a newspaper guy.
I see. Interesting. Now, a lot of writers tend to daydream a whole lot. Not necessarily newspaper writers, but, you know, because you guys are covering real facts and stories and whatnot. But as far as a fictional writer, they tend to daydream a whole lot. Do you do that?
I wouldn't say that I do that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll tell you, it's kind of related to the question that you asked.
Yeah.
Over the years, you know, again, coming up, and I'm sorry if I'm dating myself, but but when I was coming up in newspapers, it wasn't like the internet is now. There was only a certain amount of space in the newspaper,
mm-hmm.
and so when I would get an assignment, it would be to write 12 inches on this story or 14 inches on that story or 7 inches on this story. And so, you know, that over the years, that became a little frustrating. I found that a lot of the things that I found interesting were mm-hmm. never making their way into the newspaper, you know, kind of like the mm-hmm. why behind a story.
Yeah.
And so I reached a point where in the 1990s I decided to go back to school myself.
Mm-hmm.
And I went into the Johns Hopkins Master's in Fiction program.
Mm-hmm.
And that really opened the floodgates for me. You know, I had spent 20 years writing newspaper stories, you know, bunching up the information in the lead, in the first paragraph of the story, getting the who, what, when, where, why,
right.
into the, you know, as quickly as possible for the readers to digest. And this was an abrupt reversal of that. This was slowing time down, slowing these moments down, building anticipation and developing characters and all these other techniques. And I was just, you know, I was just, wow, this is what I really like.
Isn't that a big switch? Because, I mean, you're talking about just the facts, man, but it's something that you have to sort of embellish and writing some solid substance in it.
Well, I liken it to driving 35 miles down the road and throwing the car into reverse all of a sudden. Yeah, it's a very different feeling. And it was, you know, it took a while
yeah.
to get accustomed to that, because my mm-hmm. instinct over all those years mm-hmm. was to get the news out as quickly as possible.
Right, right, right. Interesting. So do you use your writing from then onwards to sort of as an escape to express yourself in a public forum in some ways, or do you just write to entertain others?
No, I write for both reasons. I mm-hmm. have stories that strike me that I want to tell,
yeah.
and I think it's more that, and then I hope that people will take something away from them, besides just being entertained. But of course, I want them to be, you know, I want it to be an escape for readers to,
yeah.
you know, help them get away from their daily lives for a little bit and meet my characters and like them or hate them or whatever. But, you know, I also want them to take away some lessons and some thoughts mm-hmm. about the books. You know, hopefully some it will inspire some provocative thoughts in the readers as well.
What life experiences influence your writing most then?
Well, I would say mostly what you'll see in my writing is my experiences in all those years of newspapering. I covered a vast array of stories, some happy, some sad, and you know, I've always been interested in a few things that I'll just talk about for a second.
Yeah.
During my career, I had to cover a couple of events that were very sad. The murder of a child, you know, accidental shootings, things like that. And I've always been interested in how people respond to profound grief. I find that some people just kind of wall themselves off and don't want to have anything to do with friends, family, society anymore. And others have the direct opposite take on it. They take their grief and they try to channel it into some constructive way to make things better. I'll give you a for instance. When I was working for Tampa, the Tampa Tribune, I had to cover John Walsh, who you may know as the head of America's Most Wanted.
Yeah.
At that time, he was just a parent and a businessman, and he was the father of Adam Walsh, who was unfortunately murdered in South Florida. Now, I caught up with this story when John and his then-wife, whose name was Reveille, would go to the state legislature in Tallahassee to lobby for tougher protection laws. So, again, here, some people wall themselves off. Some people get very involved. These two folks chose to take their grief and channel it into something very positive and constructive.
Mm-hmm.
And they did. They were fierce lobbyists for tougher child protection laws, and they got the state legislature to make some changes. You know, at the end of the day, and I think this is even in one of my books, fictitiously, you know, I think it dawned on him, you know, you get into that mode, that driving, fierce lobbying kind of mode where nothing's going to get in your way, you're going to get this done. But at the end of the day, I think it finally dawned on him that nothing he could do would bring his child back.
Right.
And I happened to be with him at that moment, and, you know, it struck him very hard, and it was sad to see and also very interesting to see. Again, how people respond to profound grief. Another thing I'm interested in is how people act when no one is watching. In other words, ethical behavior, and that to me is what you do when nobody is watching, you know, and that's everything from what might happen on a battlefield between soldiers to, you know, if you nick somebody on the fourth floor of the parking lot and nobody is around, do you leave a note?
Right.
You know? So how people respond in tough ethical situations, and that drives a lot of the action in my books. How people respond to, you know, these very challenging life situations, and how they behave when no one is watching.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. That's very true. Coming to your book as a prequel to your debut novel Bella, what is Bootlicker all about?
So Bootlicker is about a dark, decades-old secret that threatens a historic election. And let me tell you about that. So it's 1992 in the state of South Carolina. The state is about to elect its first black congressman since the Civil War. Think about that. The first black congressman since the Civil War. So it's like 100 years. The leading contender is a guy named Ike Washington, and on paper he looks like the perfect candidate. He's good-looking, he's articulate, he seems like a natural leader, but there's a dark secret in his past, and it has to do with his ties to the incumbent veteran U.S. senator for that state, who oddly has, and I say oddly because you wouldn't think of these two guys as being connected in any way, he has a he's one of those harsh segregationist, honestly racist leftovers from before the civil rights era who has somehow managed to survive into modern times. And so there is an incident that links the two, and I won't go into all that now, but you know, my guy Ike Washington is tortured by his path to power, by the realization that he would not have gotten to where he is without his tie to this U.S. senator who everyone in the black community despises because of what he had been in the past. And so we are coming up on election day, and it's not the press, it's not the senator, it's Ike himself whose guilt just overwhelms him, and he suddenly can't go on. And so he has got to figure out how he can forgive himself before he can take this historic seat and do some good for the people in his district.
It's a wonderful story, no doubt about it. I really enjoyed it. The characters you have in the book are very real, and it just absorbs you. It's a page-turner, no question about it.
Oh, well, thank you. And I forgot to mention, people always ask me where the title of the book comes from.
Yeah.
And Bootlicker, you know, it doesn't have anything to do with 50 Shades of Grey, folks. It has to do with what the black citizens of South Carolina mm-hmm. call Ike behind his back. Because mm-hmm. they know this tie to the senator and they don't like the senator, they feel that Ike is kowtowing to him, and mm-hmm. so behind his back they call him Bootlicker.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. Why did you decide to write the books, like in this case, a prequel to Bella, in that order?
Okay, well, you know, a little secret of my own is that the majority of Bootlicker was actually written before Bella. Now, I'll tell you quickly about Bella. Is the story of a young woman who loses her husband overseas. The military tells her he was killed in battle, but an anonymous source tells her that the truth is that he was killed in a friendly fire accident. So she gets the help of we were talking before about how people get on this on their missions, and they're fierce, and nothing's going to stop them from finding out the truth or taking their action, whatever it is. And so she gets the help of a Washington reporter named Dan Petrano, and the book Bella is mostly about the relationship that develops between this mysterious, alluring young widow and this unhappily married mid-career reporter, Dan Petrano. Mm-hmm. So when the reviews started coming out about Bella, one of the things that people said, it was kind of a repeated theme, is that they liked this guy Dan, and Bella is told from the point of view of Dan mm-hmm. Petrano. They liked this guy Dan, and they wanted to see me as the author put him into different scrapes and see how we could get him out of them. Mm-hmm. So when that started happening, and it started happening a lot, I thought, you know, I've got this other book, and it also has a reporter. It was a different reporter at the time, but I thought it might make sense to go back into Bootlicker and make the reporter a younger version of Dan Petrano. Mm-hmm. And so we have Dan now, if you remember what the story is about, you have mm-hmm. Dan covering this very racially charged election down in South Carolina, but he's not the Dan that you know from Bella. He's a young guy just out of college, and mm-hmm. you know, he's thrown into the turmoil of this very you know, emotionally charged election that has, you know, racial themes and you know, these guilt mm-hmm. Guilt factor and all this other stuff. And so that's how it originated, and that's how it became the prequel to Bella. Mm-hmm.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. So how did your background in political reporting in Washington, D.C. influence your novels?
Well, you know, the cliche is to write what you know, and if there's anything that I know, it's Washington reporting. But, I'll take it a step beyond that, and I'll tell you that for Bootlicker, you know, I had to cover, again, going all the way back to the beginning of our conversation, I grew up in New York, and one of the things that I think I brought to my reporting for Southern newspapers was Northern sensibilities. So I looked at things a little bit differently than perhaps someone who grew up in the South. And so I found myself, when I was working for the South Carolina paper, covering some politicians who, you know, frankly had enjoyed very long careers, but if you looked at the genesis of the origins of their careers, you know, there was some of that, in some cases, some very strong segregationist background. One actually ran for president on something called the states' rights ticket, and you know, was one of these folks who said there's not enough soldiers in the army to force us to let the Negroes into our colleges and swimming pools and things like that. And so, you know, it struck me, okay, he changed over the years, but it struck me that once the civil rights movement occurred, what I quoted to you was actually from 1948. Mm-hmm. But, you know, when I came on the scene, we were into the mid-1990s. And so it always struck me, how did somebody keep getting reelected who had that kind of background? Mm-hmm. And so over the years, it wasn't like, you know, something that I was obsessed about, but
yeah.
Over the years, I would talk to political scientists and campaign strategists and plain old citizens, university professors, and I would say, you know, I would ask my question, how does someone like that keep getting reelected? And honestly, no one had a good answer. No one had a real good answer, so I made one up and wrote a book, and that's called Bootlicker.
Very interesting. It is no question about the fact that the thought process of the South is much different than the North, and I'm here from a political standpoint of view. I'm not taking sides or anything like that, and everybody has their own belief, and it's rooted over the years, and you're right, because when you look back at it, I mean, when you talk about civil rights movements and so forth, and what was it like about a few years ago when Strom Thurmond finally passed on from South Carolina?
Yes.
I mean, mm-hmm. that must have been a big change.
Yes, and he's still very, you know, his memory is still very revered in the state, for sure.
That's very, very interesting the way you are looking at it from that perspective and trying to tell a wonderful story about real life, real situation that we need to, you know, think a lot before what we do and how we process things of that nature in terms of the racial polarity and so forth. Very interesting.
Yeah, now let me just make one thing clear because I don't want anybody to be confused. There's a very strict line that separates fact from fiction in my book, and the only
right.
thing that's true is that in 1992, South Carolina did elect its first black congressman since the Civil War. He happens to be a great congressman. He's very well respected. He's one of the highest ranking Democrats in the House of mm-hmm. Representatives now, and he had nothing to do with the person in my book. I just needed a convenient vehicle to tell my story. So, you know, I don't want anyone to think that I'm secretly revealing any kind of truths here. It's
sure.
the furthest thing from the truth.
Right. That's very true. And that brings us to some of the questions I'm going to be asking you. How much research did you do before you write Bootlicker?
Well, I did 10 years of on-the-job research because in covering the South Carolina delegation, I would not only cover them in Washington, but I would also go down to the state and travel around and you know, put faces with the names that I knew and write stories about things that were going on down there. So, you know, when you travel the districts, the congressional districts, see the cities, meet the people, you know, do interviews with everyone from, you know, the lowest workers to the mm-hmm. highest politicians, you get a pretty good feeling for what's going on. So I would say, you know, and because of my position, honestly, I was afforded access that not a lot of people had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got there's a symbiotic relationship that exists between reporters and the people that they cover, including the politicians, and they need you and you need them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my objective was always to be fair to all sides. But in the course of doing what I did, I went behind a lot of closed doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I like to think that I bring that to the novels that I write.
Is that why you would describe your novels basically as real?
I would say realistic, not real.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Because neither story is real
mm-hmm.
in the sense that it's, you know, a fact masquerading as fiction. They're
yeah.
not intended to be real. They're
yeah.
stories that Steve created in his wild imagination. And, yeah, no, I don't want anybody to be confused that these
right.
are supposed to be true. Yeah.
Right. But I think the elements of it certainly can be realistically happening right now behind closed doors.
Yeah, in some cases, yes. What I think may lend an air of realism to the
mm-hmm.
stories is the dialogue. You know, I interviewed
mm-hmm.
people
mm-hmm.
for 25 years. I grew to learn mm-hmm. and understand how they spoke, the kinds of things they said. You know,
mm-hmm.
I like to think the dialogue rings true,
mm-hmm.
even though it's fiction.
Right.
And I'm hoping that people get, you know, absorbed and caught up in the characters. who, by the way, I happen to miss. You know, when you, when an author finishes writing a book, you're no longer dealing with your characters, and so I find that I miss them, even the bad ones.
So what made you choose the various characters in the book?
Well, I, you know, you have a story, you have your protagonist, and then you kind of, he's like the center of the universe, or she, and then you build these other people around him. I'll tell you something that I do that I think I learned as a reporter, that it's a technique that I think has helped me. When I'm writing, one of the things that I'll do is, even if I'm in the middle of a story, I will stop and I will devise 3, 5, 7 questions for the main characters. And just, you know, sit down at the computer and read the question and then try to answer in the character's voice. You know, it takes a certain amount of self-discipline to relinquish the control that an author has and just let the character speak. But I found that if I did this and I really let loose, the characters would answer in honest voices and take me places I may not have expected to go. And hopefully that accounts for some of the twists and turns in the book.
Very interesting. So how much information in the book is facts and how much is fiction? I know that you've done a lot of research, but there are certain elements of it, I'm very sure, in terms of procedure-wise and so forth, that are very, very true.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, you can't there are certain factual things that just have to be true and correct. Mm-hmm. And so, for instance, in Bella, I people always ask me if Bella is modeled after the Pat Tillman story, which is about the Arizona Cardinal football player who died in a friendly fire death. But the fact is that we were in production before that actually happened. And then during my research, which is what you were asking about, I learned that there are friendly fire deaths in every war, and they go, and that goes back to the beginning of war. So it's nothing, it was nothing new. And, you know, I had Dan as the reporter doing some of this research and kind of conveying to the readers that information in hopefully a more entertaining way than I just said it. But but yeah, you want to convey information without dragging the story down. That's my goal.
Very interesting. So how much of you is in the book, because all authors like to sort of embed themselves into the book?
Well, I'll tell you something that I do, Johnny. I have a standing deal with book clubs. And if the book club selects my book, on the night that they discuss it, and I've done 25 or 30 of these, and it's always very entertaining for me, and I hope it is for the clubs as well. On the night they discuss it, I will go over to wherever they're doing it, somebody's house, an apartment, wherever, and do like, you know, a half an hour, 45 minutes of Q&A with the book club members. And like I said, I've done this 25 or so times, and it's always great. The wine starts flowing. It's me and 13 women, and the questions get very pointed. And the first one is always, are you the reporter in the book? And, you know, I quickly say no. I am a happily married reporter who would never have an affair with a source on a main story like our guy Dan does in Bella. So, you know, I, at the same time, I've seen things like that happen during my career. And so it's not such a far stretch for me to imagine it and write it. So, you know, I bring to the stories my knowledge of journalism, of journalistic ethics, of the situations that the characters find themselves in, but I am not the reporter in the story. I am in the story in ways, but not in that way.
Wonderful. What is the most difficult thing for you to write in Bootlicker?
Okay, so Bootlicker, we're dealing with a black man who is tortured by the secret that he's carrying around. And, you know, I am with him in a lot of the scenes. There's a lot of inner dialogue. There's a lot, you know, inner thought going on. There's a lot of traveling to events and campaign stops where there's not a white person present.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I wanted to be extremely careful about, you know, I don't think that, yeah, I think the book has racial themes, but it's not about race.
Mm-hmm.
It's about decisions,
mm-hmm,
and the decisions that this guy made and has to make. That said, you know, there are those scenes that I just described, and
mm-hmm,
you know, they have to be true. And I, you know, I'm a white middle class kid from New York, and I was very sensitive to how that would come across.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to be able to defend every word that was in that book. If someone said to me, "Hey, how dare you? You're this white middle class kid from New York. How dare you try to write this? You,
mm-hmm,
you don't know what it's like."
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I got a lot of feedback from friends of mine who are African American.
Yeah.
You know, I did travel the districts in South Carolina. I, you know, met a lot of the people, talked with them in depth. I attended events. I watched. I was a very careful observer, filled up notebooks full of information. So I guess that would be one of the hardest things there mm-hmm was to write. And then the other thing that I would say falls in that category is this business about responding to profound grief. Thank God that I have never had to respond to something that devastating as
mm-hmm
losing a spouse or carrying around a guilty secret for decades, you know. So you can only imagine what that feels like. So, again, I wanted to be very sensitive in how I portrayed that. It had to be realistic. It had to ring true. And without being schmaltzy, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very interesting. What is the message in your books that you want your readers to grasp?
Well, let's start with Bootlicker.
Mm-hmm.
Bootlicker is a story of, you know, at its basest form of guilt, hope, and redemption. I think that one of the things I want readers to take away is that all is not lost if you make a mistake, even if it's a big mistake, that there is hope, that there is a second chance possible. You know, see the error of your ways, make changes that you need to make, and do good to feel good.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In Bella, you know, I guess the big one in Bella would be, you know, think twice before you do something. Think twice before, look before you leap, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because our reporter friend Dan just makes some awful choices,
mm-hmm,
and jeopardizes not only his career but his family as well.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think that's the big one for Bella.
In Bootlicker, you just talked about the redemption aspects of things, because if you look back last several years, so to speak, all the way to, I guess, the Clinton presidency and all the things, the goof-up, and then you look at John Edwards and what he went through, do you think that there are a lot of politicians out there that are still searching within themselves?
I'm really careful about generalizing like that, but
yeah.
I will tell you this. you know, one of the things that Washington reporters like to do is write the first day on the job story when
yeah
somebody new enters
yeah
Congress.
Yeah.
And there was a congressman, I won't mention names, but mm-hmm there was a congressman first elected, and I covered that first day that he was on the job. And, you know, with all the hoopla, we all walked with him to the House chambers, where he got in the elevator, and lo and behold, there is an elevator operator
mm-hmm
to go two floors. And he was frankly embarrassed that someone thought he would need someone to operate the elevator for him. And you
right
know, he blushed, and it was kind of amusing to see. Now, this same guy, 3 years later, in the midst of his second term,
mm-hmm,
would not walk through a door unless somebody held it open for him. So there's something in the water. Call it Potomac fever, call it whatever you want, but I think it's rare, and we should look for it when we find someone who remembers where he came from, and maintains the values that he arrived with that first day.
But do you find yourself wanting to write a fresh perspective about how politicians should think and conduct themselves?
Well, I'm frankly, it was a very big lift to complete the second book, and for probably the next year or so, I'll be working mostly on marketing and promotion and getting out and talking about the books.
Yeah.
There are some loose ends in Bella, and there are some loose ends in Bootlicker that I am thinking about tying up in a third novel. It's very much at the conception stage now, so we'll see how that works out. But, yeah, I mean, not just politicians. I'm just interested in human behavior, period.
Right. Well, it so happens in this particular case it is focused on the politicians, so to speak.
Yeah.
But you're right, because your book does talk about, when it's all said and done, it is about human instincts and how we react as a human being, and at what point in time do we allow our love to exceed our fear. Because are we operating our life from a fear perspective, or are we operating our life from a love perspective?
Yeah, very good point. Yes.
And that changes the dynamics on how we interact with others, as well as, most importantly, the energy that we put out there.
Yes, very true. Very true.
Tell us a little bit about your road to publication.
Okay, so... you know, again, going back to the very beginning, the program, the Johns Hopkins program that I got into, was very instrumental in helping me get to fiction writing, get those gates unleashed, and really start writing fiction. During that program, I had ideas about publishing a novel, and you know, flashing forward to Bella. I did obtain a traditional agent. You know, it used to be, even as recently as 5 years ago, the road to literary success went this way. You wrote your book, you got an agent, you queried around and tried to find an agent. If you were lucky enough to get one, you appealed to the agent to help you get a publisher. The publisher... she would shop it around, or he would shop it around, and hopefully a major publishing house would be interested. You'd get a contract, you'd get an editor, and eventually you'd get published. I got the agent, but the agent did not get the publisher. We never did get a publisher. Several expressed interest. We sent the manuscript off. And for one reason or another, but for no consistent reason, no one bought the book. I was in a position where I don't remember the exact number, but let's say 20 asked for the manuscript, and we got 7 responses back after we sent it off. Mm-hmm. And so I was like, you know, what are we doing about getting a response from the other 13? And the agent was like, you know, don't tell me my business. I'm sort of an aggressive fellow, and I don't have, you know, a ton of patience. I have some, but I don't have a ton. And roughly around this time, and this was going back about 4 years ago now, I coincidentally ran into and made friends with several 20-somethings who were very well versed in social media. And I told my story, and one of them asked to read the book, and which was, at that point, was a pile of pages. And she happened to love it and came back and said, you know, we don't really need this agent publisher thing. The technology has changed to the point where you can self-publish, and we can use social media to reach out and contact readers directly. Now, remember who you're talking to. You're talking to someone who is in journalism for 20-plus years, and to me that's a very democratic, with a small d, notion.
Yeah.
the idea that actual readers, people, real people, will decide whether or not your book is worth reading.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought about it and, you know, essentially dissolved the contract with my agent and took on this self-publishing odyssey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at the time, I made a decision that I would also document my adventures.
Mm-hmm.
So on my website, stevepiacente.com, I have a blog that I call Backstory. And in Backstory, if you were to go there now, you would see there are probably 75 posts on all the things that I've done, techniques, tips, stories from behind the scenes that have gotten us to this point. Because
mm-hmm.
I wanted it for two reasons. One, I wanted to document the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And two, I wanted to share what I was learning with other people who might have been in the same position as myself. So I've had fun doing that. It's kind of the reporter in me, you know, telling these stories. I think there's a human instinct to know what's going on behind the curtain. It's the Wizard of Oz thing. You know, who's back there pulling the levers? How does it work? And I think this is true whether it's, you know, putting out a newspaper or just the guy who dry cleans your shirt. You know, what's going on back there? How does he get it so straight and stiff and perfect? I just think that when we take the cameras, or in this case, the human eye, behind the scenes, people are interested in what's going on back there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I've done. And you know, the original question was about self-publishing, and I'm kind of telling you all this because I think it's interesting how the world has changed, how, you know, this once very solid foundation in the publishing industry has just changed radically. It's like there's been a series of earthquakes, and the ground is shifting, and it hasn't really settled yet.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm having fun with it, and the other thing that's happened quite unexpectedly is that as I've written about my self-publishing adventures, I've somehow become Steve the self-publishing expert. It was never a goal to do that, but you know, there are so many people who want to write, have this, you know, this calling to write,
right,
and to share their writing with others, that I've, you know, my blog posts and some other things have caught on, and, you know, we're now up to, like, I think it's like 1,500 Twitter followers, and I do webinars for a company that is helping self-publishers, and I do webinars on how to launch your book and how to use social media tools and several other things. And, you know, Johnny, there's one thing that I've really learned is that in going through this experience, there's no one direct path to success. You know, I've seen self-publishers succeed in a number of different ways, and, you know, there's no one answer, there's no one right way. And maybe my right way is to do it as the self-publishing guy. You know, because every time I do a webinar, every time I tweet, I'm mentioning my book, I'm mentioning my website, and so you know, I'd sort of rather it be the reverse, like, hey, I'm Steve, and I've written these books, and here's how I did it. Instead, it's become, hey, I'm Steve, here's how I did it, and by the way, here are my books. But like I said, there's no direct path.
Yeah. That lady that told you about the social media, did she help you to get started?
Yeah, there was a small group of them, and they all helped in the beginning. And then we've kind of moved on, and you know, everybody works, everybody has jobs, and the one thing about self-publishing is that the more you get into it, if you're successful, the more demanding it is, and so, you know, we eventually, like I said, reached a point where we had to take on some part-time help, and, you know, in addition to that, I've been blessed with family and friends who have helped enormously, and I'll put my wife, Felicia, into that category. She's been a tremendous support and help, and continues to this day. We're planning events in South Carolina and Miami as I speak, and she's in charge. I ask her where to go and when to be there.
Must be nice. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Okay, well, we have, you know, I'll just mention a couple of other things while when I answer that question. We have one of the things I always say is that the good news is also the bad news when it comes to self-publishing. The good news is that technology has made it possible to do all this. The bad news is that everyone is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And by that I mean that the market is very cluttered with a lot of stuff.
Right.
So we've done a few things that try to help us stand out. And one of those is that we've made video trailers for both books. And these are not your standard, you know, tech screens and music.
Mm-hmm.
These are actual full-blown productions with actors and music and scripts. And so I would urge people who even have a slight interest to go check out my website at stevepiacente.com and just watch the trailers. In each case, for Bootlicker and Bella, the two-minute trailers that you see required 6 months of work.
Wow.
Yeah, so that was it was a big effort, but you know, I think the trailer can be your calling card, the first introduction people have to you. So I wanted them to be right, and I wanted to be very involved in the process. And we like I said, we put a lot of work in it, but I think it paid off. So hopefully people will go and agree. And when you get to the website, you'll see both book covers. All you need to do is click them, and it'll take you right to the Amazon site, where you can purchase them either as paperback or Kindle.
Wonderful. How has writing the two novels impacted you personally?
I would say it's changed my life in many ways because I'll answer it this way. I have a lot of writer friends who would prefer just to write. You know, they sit in their office, they sit behind the computer, and they write their work. And, you know, they think that's enough. They think that somebody's going to go around and somehow find them. And, you know, I have been in journalism. I've been in public affairs. And I understand how, you know, how busy average people are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talk about discretionary income. I think there's also a thing I call discretionary leisure time, and that's the hour, maybe 2 hours, people have at the end of the day when they, you know, they don't have to think about anything. The kids are taken care of, the car is okay, the job's done for the day, and they have a little time to relax. In that time, think about what you're competing with: movies and TV and other books and you know, going to see a ball game and whatever else. I just think that if you want people to even pay the slightest bit of attention to you, you have to be out there. You have to be out there making a name for yourself and your work, and you have to be doing it in creative and innovative ways. And so, you know, when you ask how it's impacted my life, I'm all over the place. I mean, I'm physically doing readings and signings and speaking to book clubs as much as I can. But I'm also on social media. We're very active on Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and now Pinterest. I don't know if you're familiar with Pinterest, but Pinterest is the like a digital corkboard where you can create your own board and pin to it, digitally pin to it, anything that you're interested in that you find on the web. Well, most people think of pictures or photographs when they think of Pinterest, but it turns out that upwards of 80% of Pinterest users, and it's a phenomenally fast-growing site, 80% are women, and women are the folks who happen to be buying the most books. So if you're an author, you need to be active on Pinterest also. So we've tried to come up with creative ways to use Pinterest to reach those people. So this is a long answer to your question, Johnny, but I would say it's impacted my life in a very profound way in that, you know, any leisure time that I have is spent trying to reach readers through these various vehicles that we have at our disposal now.
Very interesting. So what's next for you then?
sleep.
I thought you had to pin that in, though.
Yeah, I have to schedule some sleep on my calendar. No, I am very excited because we're going to Miami in November because Bella has won the Reader's Favorite Gold Medal Award for Dramatic Fiction for 2012. And there's an award ceremony in Miami in mid-November. And so we're going down there to participate in the ceremony, to drop by the Miami Book Fair, and hopefully we're going to find a book club or some writing group to speak to when we go down as well.
Fantastic. That's wonderful. Do you have any advice for aspiring authors out there?
Yeah, don't think about marketing or promotion ahead of time. Think about writing the best darn story that you can write. I would also say don't try to write what you think will sell. I would say write what's calling to you. I think too many times talented writers wind up writing what they think will sell, and that guides how they write as opposed to what I think you should do, which is write the story that you feel you're being called to tell. To me, that's like a politician deciding what his vote is going to be based on focus groups. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You should write what's in your heart and really be true to that. And only then, there's another step, because I think too many times authors rush to market without getting their books professionally edited. So I would say, after you write the best book you can, have it professionally edited by someone who doesn't know you and who doesn't care about hurting your feelings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then, and only then, just take the next steps, which is, you know, either seek out an agent to go the traditional route or begin the self-publishing process.
So what do you think makes a good story?
A good story is, well, I think a lot of things make a good story. One of them comes right to mind is that people will miss your characters people will miss reading the book when they're done.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think you want your writing to be such that it leaves them thinking, perhaps questioning the foundation of their own beliefs. You know, I want them to want more when mm-hmm. they're done. I think it should be bigger than just, you know, an event happening in your book. I think it should have more profound lessons at the end of the day. Things like that.
Interesting. So regardless whether you're writing a fiction or just a normal nonfiction book, there is a sort of a take-home value that you need to deliver.
Oh, yeah. I think that's the difference between books and, say, TV shows.
Mm-hmm.
You know, most of the time you'll watch a TV show and you'll be entertained in the moment. And mm-hmm. then pretty much most of the time after that, you forget about it. You know, you move on. I think that authors have an opportunity to, when they write, to create something that's more long-lasting, that stands the test of time better, and that people will want to share with other people.
Very true. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the show. Do you have a recipe for living you would like to share with our listeners this morning?
Yeah, and I'll relate it to the book, but I think it's bigger than writing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So in the beginning, when I was starting off with all this, I was a little bit obsessed with book sales.
Mm-hmm.
And everything that I did, whether it was going to Annapolis and sitting at a bookstore, in front of a bookstore, meeting people, you know, it was geared around, I measured success by how many books I sold.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I've come to think, my thinking has evolved. My thinking has evolved. And I think this is where the larger lesson lies, and that has to do with enjoying the process. It has to do with, you know, realizing that you're meeting people that you wouldn't have met otherwise. You're going to places that you wouldn't have gone to had you not written. And enjoying those experiences. It's not the destination. My destination, my goal is not to become some famous author and never have to have a day job again. That's not what it's about for me. I would love to be able to write full time, but in the interim, I'm enjoying the ride. And I think if we could all take away that lesson, that would be really helpful. I drive from suburban Maryland to downtown Washington in the morning, and just the way I see people racing around the highway to get to work, I don't know. It just strikes me, what, first of all, you're not really gaining that much time, and whatever, if you happen to arrive 3, 5, 7 minutes earlier than you would have, what are you really doing with that time? So, you know, enjoy the ride, I guess is what I'm saying. Don't be in such a rush. Enjoy the ride.
Very interesting, because a lot of times we are focused, ironically, on the sales, because everyone talked about that, though. Unfortunately, we can't escape that, but you're talking about once you let that go, it'll just come.
Yeah, and I think, you know, I think if you believe in your product, if your product is a good one, it will take care of itself. It will not happen like, you know, the pilot presses on the levers and the plane lifts off in a nice smooth ascent.
Yeah.
I think it's more like almost like a heart patient where it spikes up and down, and it's really hard to predict sometimes. But that's my take on it.
And you're actually living a legacy as well.
Yeah, hopefully. We had a. I'll tell you this. I'll share this. We recently had a book launch party, and we had I think upwards of 50 people there, and three of those people were my grown up children, and I was proud to be doing what I was doing, and I, you know, I could see in their eyes that they were proud also. So that was very wonderful for me.
Wonderful. Any final thoughts about Bootlicker?
Just that I hope people pick it up, I hope they enjoy it, and I hope they tell me about it.
I'm sure they will. What are some of the comments that you have received for the book?
You know, some people, and this is why I try to make that very clear, some people say it feels very real, like did it really happen? And
right.
It didn't, and that's why I'd like to be really clear about that. They like the characters, they despise the senator, they feel ambivalent about Ike. You know, he did this bad thing. He did this bad thing, but now there's hope that he's going to do a good thing. So, you know, we're getting interesting feedback on it.
Well, it did come out during the most challenging period of our political system right now, where it's sort of a bipolar attitude that we have out there when it comes to our political culture right now. So that's quite interesting. So I can see how easy it is for someone to mistake this as being something truthful. And, of course, your writing has a lot to do with it as well. I mean, it's very, very real. So that makes a big difference.
Well, thank you. We like to call it a hot election story and a hot election year.
Wonderful. Well, Steve, thank you for the great recipe for living that you had shared with us just now and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join us next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Dr. Julie Silva. Dr. Julie and I will be discussing about her latest book titled Hope and Healing for Your Breast Cancer Journey. This book is written in partnership with Chicken Soup for the Soul to honor breast cancer survivors. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a great week. Steve, thank you again and have a great day.
Johnny, it was a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.